In December of 1988, four incidents in and outside of South London, two car thefts and two home invasions, left eight victims in their wake. One man severely injured, another brutally murdered, and a number of cars and other goods stolen. The victims and witnesses all described three assailants, two white men and one black man. The brutality of the crimes garnered national attention, as well as mounting pressure to bring those responsible to justice. It is believed that the first car theft was traced to a hostel where 18-year-old Raphael Rowe lived with five other men. On December 19th, he and his hostel mates, along with several others, were arrested. Despite the prior identification of the perpetrators as two white men and one black man, and solid alibi witnesses, police focused their investigation on Raphael and two other black men, Michael Davis and Randolph Johnson. It became clear at trial that the prosecution was relying on information from an incentivized informant who was involved in the crimes. Discrepancies between the victims and witnesses' initial reports and their testimonies at trial raised suspicion. Despite all of that, plus Raphael and Michael's alibi witnesses and the description of two white and one black assailant, the jury convicted all three black men, and Raphael was sentenced to life plus 50 years. During his incarceration, Raphael was able to develop evidence with the help of journalists to shed light on the details of his wrongful conviction, including official misconduct and the fabrication of a false narrative. Raphael joins us today to share his harrowing story and his continued fight to clear his name. This is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Today, we're taking you overseas to Southeast England for a wrongful conviction case that is, it's a powerful story, not least of which because the man who lived it has a way of telling it that is, it rocks my world. So I think this is going to be a wild episode, and I'm really honored to have with us today the man himself, Raphael Rowe. Raphael, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you for inviting me onto your podcast.
Yeah. I never had the privilege of interviewing a wrongfully convicted person who is themselves a podcaster, journalist. But let's go back all the way to even before this happened, right? These were crimes that took place in December 1988, a series of robberies, violent robberies in Southeast England. It's like something out of Clockwork Orange or worse. And they're much more than robberies. There was a murder. There were other types of home invasions. I mean, when I say robberies, it sounds too benign to describe what was really going on here. But what was your life like before all this insanity happened?
So I grew up in Southeast London in a very deprived neighborhood. We had council houses, which are sort of social housing. I come from a mixed race background. My father came to the United Kingdom on the Windrush as a Jamaican. My mother is a born and bred Londoner from West London. And when they got together, they had my three sisters, and then along came me. And my dad was a laborer. My mum was a housewife bringing up four kids. And so financially, we struggled as a young family, but we had quite a stable upbringing. Of course, there were problems in our household. You know, my dad liked to drink. My mum and dad would argue. But on the street, everybody was struggling and trying to make ends meet. Everybody came from a working class background, and we all grew up in small flats, in blocks of flats. You know, I come from a neighborhood where riots had kicked off in the United Kingdom because of the oppression of people like myself, in particular black people in and around London, especially migrants. To be honest, there was no one in my life in my early teens that inspired me to become anything. You know, everybody around me were just looking to earn money. And for me, as a young teenager, that was about being involved in petty crime. And so by the age of 18, I'd got in trouble with the law, and I was put on what we call probation. And at that point, I went to live in a hostel with one of my best friends. And in this hostel in Southeast London, there were lots of other sort of wayward kids, if you like, people who had also been sent there by the authorities for getting in trouble with the law. And I was living with my best friend, Michael, partying, doing the things that you do as a teenager without a care in the world.
And so that brings us to this insane series of events of four separate violent, hyper-violent robberies that took place between December 13th and December 16th of 1988. The first crime took place in Sydenham on December 13th, where two men stole a car, a Triumph Spitfire, in the middle of the night and took it back to 25 Lorrie Park Road, which was the hostel that you were living in that you just described. Now, the next crime took place a few days later on December 16th in Fickleshaw, where three masked men interrupted Peter Herberg and a younger man named Alan Ely as they were having sex in a car. The masked men had a knife and a gun. Ely was pulled from the car and robbed of £10, and it was clear that the three masked men intended to steal the car. When Herberg objected, he was attacked. Ely passed out, and when he awoke, he found that Herberg was dead after having been savagely beaten. He had fractured ribs, a bruised heart, and he had actually died from a heart attack, obviously as a result of the beating. This car, by the way, an Austin Princess, was gone. But the stolen car from the 13th, the Triumph Spitfire, was discovered abandoned close to the scene. The Austin Princess was then driven to Oxted, which is about 10 miles away, where the three men invaded and robbed a home. There was a violent struggle, and one of the home's occupants was cut badly with his artery severed. The house was ransacked, and the robbers left with the man's Toyota. Now, here, too, the car from the previous robbery that night, an Austin Princess, was found abandoned near the home. And in the final incident, an hour later, about 20 miles from Oxted, in a place called Fetchham, a couple woke up in their bed to find three masked men in their room. The robbers asked them for money, jewelry, and car keys, and the couple was then tied and gagged while the robbers ransacked the house. The men eventually left, driving off in a Renault and a Vauxhall Cavalier. As before, the stolen Toyota from the previous robbery was found nearby, and the Renault and Vauxhall were later found abandoned and burned out in a field. So this is four separate incidents in which eight people were robbed. One was severely injured and another one killed in a truly grotesque manner.
These robberies hit the front pages of all the national newspapers. The headlines were things like two white men, one black man commit horrors. M25 gang, which is what these three men were dubbed. Catch these monsters, bring back hanging, £25,000 reward for the arrest of these monsters, etc.
£25,000 back then was a huge amount of money, right? We're talking about 1988. I don't know what that would be in current dollars or with the exchange rate, but I would say it's well over $100,000 in today's money. What I will say is that in case after case, we see that these type of rewards, which sound like a good idea on paper, lead to people who want the money saying things that they might otherwise know not to be true or guessing. So how did they come to target you and the others?
Well, the facts don't materialize as to why we were initially targeted until many years after I'd spent time in prison. The reason the police targeted our address was because they were given a tip-off. I believe that there was different evidence that led them to our address, i.e. the cars that had been discovered from the final robbery that were burnt out. Witnesses saw people standing over those cars at the time and described those individuals to the police. And I think the police then made some inroads on who those people were. Two of those people were living in the same address as me, two white guys. All of the victims described the perpetrators as two white men and one black man. One of the most significant factors in this case, all of the victims of these crimes, as terrified as they were able to give a consistent account of what the perpetrators looked like, despite the fact that these robbers were wearing balaclavas.
And in case anyone in our audience is unfamiliar with the term balaclava, it's a ski mask. Anyway, continue.
When the victims described the perpetrators having described one of the white men with blue eyes and fair hair, another white man whose skin they saw through the eye hole and the mouth of one of the balaclavas was white, and the black man, they said, had brown skin with quite a chubby face. So that was the level of detail. When I was arrested and my co-defendants were arrested, the three men that ended up being charged were all black. I had dreadlocks at the time. My co-defendant had dreadlocks at the time. And the other co-defendant was of dark black African appearance. So all three black men who were eventually charged didn't fit the descriptions that were not only described by the victims, but it was also repeated in these headlines that the police were looking for two white men and one black man, and that two white men were seen burning the cars, and et cetera, et cetera. So the details were quite obvious. How could the police go on to charge three black men?
Right. These were not identifications that were given from across the street or down the road where you might say, well, maybe they were mistaken about the race. Maybe it was dark. The streetlight didn't work, something like that. No, these were up close and personal crimes. And there's no way that everybody got the race of the perpetrators wrong.
You're absolutely right, Jason. These weren't fleeting glances across the road in the dead of night. There was a level of detail that you could not excuse.
And this was certainly a case as well where you would hope that the authorities would be on their A game because everybody needed these guys off the streets. I mean, whoever did this are literally the people for whom prisons are built.
I totally agree with you, Jason. I think the problem is when these sensational headlines put politicians and lawmakers, the police under extreme pressure, they then start to target people that are innocent. They then home in on people who are the most vulnerable, i.e. those types of individuals like myself, who the public wouldn't care about.
This episode is underwritten by AIG, a leading global insurance company. AIG is committed to corporate social responsibility and is making a positive difference in the lives of its employees and in the communities where we work and live. In light of the compelling need for pro bono legal assistance and in recognition of AIG's commitment to criminal and social justice reform, the AIG Pro Bono Program provides free legal services and other support to underrepresented communities and individuals.
Twelve people were arrested on the 19th of December 1988 under suspicion of being involved in these crimes. I was one of them. My co-defendant, Michael Davis, who was also my best friend and lived with me in the hostel, as was a number of other individuals who lived in that hostel. Three in particular, three young white guys, were also arrested, as was a young Asian guy. But it was only me, my co-defendant, and the three white guys who remained in the police station being interviewed and interrogated by the police between the 19th of December and the 22nd of December 1988, when I was charged and then sent to a remand prison to await trial. My friend Michael was remanded in custody. The two white guys and the Asian guy were not charged with the murder and the series of robberies. And it was about 3 weeks later that Randolph Egbert Johnson, who was involved in a high-speed car chase with the police, was arrested, and he became the third suspect in the so-called M25 case. Randolph, I didn't know him. I had no association with him. I think I'd met him once before, but we had no connection at all.
And so tell me about the police interrogation.
There were two particular police officers who were responsible for my arrest, and these two cops were typical of your good cop, bad cop type guys. One of them hated me from the moment he set eyes on me. The other one was slightly more reserved, always thoughtful and reflective of my answers, and he always gave me some confidence that he was believing me, because I was not one of those suspects who sat in the police cell saying, no comment, no comment. No, I took every opportunity to tell them that I was not involved, that they were pointing the finger at the wrong guy. I was providing them with as much detail as I possibly could about where I was, who I was with, what I was doing. And it fell on deaf ears. And the reason for that is because the other suspects that the police were interrogating were telling lies, were making stories up. And I'd go as far as to say they were conspiring with other police officers at the time to fabricate evidence that would then be used against me. You know, even the victims themselves, who I have all the sympathy for in the world as to what they experience, even they started to change their statements. So every time I told the police where I was and what I was doing and who I was with, they quickly got people to change their statements or their time so that it would undermine the evidence that proved unequivocally that I was innocent. And do you know why that is, Jason? During the interrogation, the police have it in their head that they've got the right people. The evidence that's coming into the interview room, all these fabricated bits of evidence which were convincing the police that they were onto the right guys, regardless of the victim's descriptions. The problem was is that by the time they were starting to discover the real evidence, i.e. the evidence that proved I had an alibi, the evidence that proved I could not have been involved in these crimes, it was too late. So that's why they then went back to witnesses and victims and started to get them to change their statement. And that's easy for the police to do when you believe in the police. And these victims are law-abiding citizens who go by whatever the police tell them they need to go by.
You know, I have to point out that in America, there's only one state, which is Minnesota, where they record eyewitness interrogations. And I feel that's a reform that needs to be instituted nationwide and worldwide, because most people understand the reason why you need to record interrogations of suspects to make sure they're not being beaten, coerced, fed information, et cetera, but in some cases, including this one, that would have been extremely valuable to have access to the videotapes of these incredibly suggestive eyewitness identification procedures. I mean, they were not even being suggested. They're being told, you're wrong. Don't believe your eyes. Believe us.
And I should say now, there was absolutely no forensic evidence or any other kind of scientific evidence in this case that pointed to me or my co-defendants. In fact, the opposite was true. There was some forensic evidence, i.e. fingerprints found on the car at the scene of the murder, that linked the case to a white guy with blue eyes and fair hair, i.e. fitted the description as described by some of the victims. And when the police discovered that, and I'm already locked up in prison, charged with these crimes, they went to this witness and they got this witness to say that they stole the car that was used in the robbery for me and my co-defendants, rather than interrogate that individual about their involvement.
It's a tangled freaking web, man. This is a lot. And Raphael, let's get to your alibi, because you had multiple people testifying to where you were during the crimes, right? Please take us through this.
Initially, in the witness that survived statement, the murder was timed at taking place at 11:30 p.m. on the night of the 15th of December, 1988. At that time, me and my co-defendant were with four girls who we were knocking about with. I was sleeping with one of those girls, and at about 10:30 on the night of the murder and these series of robberies, one of the girls invited me and my friend and her mate back to her parents' house. So at about 10:30, the girls and my co-defendant went back to this other girl's house. I met her mum for the first time. I met her sister, and I met her sister's boyfriend, who was a solicitor. And we were there until about 12:30. All these witnesses verify this. So that's an hour after the murder had been committed. And at about 12:30, the solicitor wanted to get rid of this rowdy couple of guys who were smoking weed and bouncing around with their dreadlocks. The solicitor offered to give me and my friend a lift back to our flat. And we agreed. And the solicitor drove me, my co-defendant, the girl I was sleeping with, back to my flat. And we arrived back at about just 12:40 in the morning. I went back to my room with this girl. We smoked a joint and then we made love. So I was in bed with her until about 1:30 in the morning. So this is 2 hours after the murder had been committed. This was just as the second robbery was taking place. And I'm 40 miles away from where these incidents were already taking place. And this was my alibi. And all of these witnesses I just mentioned came into the court at the time of my trial and told the jury that I was with them at this time. And this is why the police got that first victim to change their statement. They said that the crime didn't happen at 11:30. It happened at 12:30. But even then, I still had an alibi that put me miles away from where this crime was committed. But crucially, the girlfriend that I was in bed with was then undermined by the police, because she gave the police items of jewelry that had come from one of the robberies, saying that she got that jewelry from me. That was an outright lie, and I can tell you why. When I was in prison a few months later, this girl wrote me a letter, unbeknown that it would be crucial evidence, admitting that she'd lied and that she'd been put up by the police to telling the police that I'd given her items of jewellery in order to save herself from being accused of perverting the course of justice or something like that. So A, I had a cast iron alibi. B, the police's attempt to undermine my alibi witnesses' credibility by fabricating evidence, which she admitted was untrue. That's what we were up against at the time of my trial.
Yeah, they're changing the times. They're changing the races of the perpetrators. They're coercing threatening eyewitnesses and alibi witnesses. It's a whirlwind. So the trial itself, Raphael, it must have been a circus atmosphere, if I'm going to guess. Please tell us about that experience. Here you are now, all of a sudden, I'm going to say one of the most hated men in the country, along with your co-defendants.
The court setting was at the Old Bailey, which is the number one court in the United Kingdom. And yes, it was a circus. Me and my two co-defendants, all three of us stood in the dock, accused of the murder and the three robberies and the attempted murder. And witness after witness, including the victims who stood up in the dock and gave evidence against us. Some told the truth, many told lies. One of the most awkward moments, Jason, in the trial was when the victims stood in the dock and they were asked to describe the perpetrators. And that's when the ums and ahs started to come in. You know, the victims were, yeah, I did say that it was white skinned. And yes, I did say they had blue eyes. But maybe I was wrong. Why was you wrong? Well, the police seemed to believe that those men in the dock were guilty. That was one of the saddest things for me, that the victims could look at the three guys that were in the dock, know that we didn't commit the crime and couldn't do anything about it. And yet somehow that jury, they went out and they came back and they found us guilty.
So, yeah, in spite of the fact that the victims are acknowledging their own original identifications of these white, blonde, blue-eyed individuals, and in spite of the fact of your many alibi witnesses, in spite of all of that, the jury goes out and finds you guilty. So can you take us back to that moment?
When the jury came in and they read the guilty verdict against me for murder, for attempted murder, and for three serious robberies, the judge had no alternative but to send me to prison for the rest of my life, plus 50 odd years, which is the accumulation of all the sentences added up for the robberies. It's really difficult to say at that point that I was crushed like a peanut under my foot, because I'd already been crushed when I was first charged with these offences and condemned to prison. I was crushed, and it was during those 18 months that I built a resilience within myself, a determination not to allow them to get away with what they were doing, not just to me and my family, but also the victims and anybody else that was being caught up wrongly. So by the time the jury came in and found me guilty, as crushing as that was, as desperate as I was, a 21-year-old destined to spend the rest of my life in prison for a crime I didn't commit, I knew I was not going to give up. I knew that they got it wrong. They knew that they got it wrong. So I was never, ever going to allow this to sit on that day forevermore. I think it was the fact that I became so militant as a young 21-year-old that I did everything I possibly could to keep my body as fit as I possibly could in order to withstand the four walls that I was being confined in. So rather than sit in that cell, I exercised in that cell, used it as my gym, used it as my office, used it as the space that I was going to work my way out, whether that was psychologically or physically. So I was studying the law, teaching myself as much as I possibly could about the law in order to understand how and why what had happened to me happened to me. And I should stress that in those years, I was so militant. I did not conform. I refused to work in prison. Every day as a convicted person, you are expected to follow the regime of the maximum security prison, i.e. you go to work, you do the things the authorities expect you to do as a guilty man. Well, I wasn't a guilty man, so I was going to do everything in the opposite. So when they opened my cell door and shouted my name to go to work, I refused to leave the cell. The consequence would mean that they would come into the cell and physically drag me out of the cell, take me to the isolation block where I would spend days or weeks or months being punished for not being prepared to put up with what guilty people had to endure. And that went on for years. It was me against the system as well as my wrongful conviction. And I mean, I was brutalized so badly by the authorities for not conforming. There were plenty of times where they physically beat me or locked me in isolation cells completely naked for no other reason than they could.
So now, from inside the confines of these barbaric prisons that you were in, how did you manage to ultimately free yourself?
One of the big turning points for me, Jason, was the media, the publications, the broadcasters played a significant role in my wrongful conviction by calling me a monster, by asking for hanging to be brought back into the United Kingdom to kill people like me who were guilty of such horrible crimes. If the media could play such a powerful role in my wrongful conviction, maybe they could play a role in getting my conviction overturned. So I embarked on a journalism correspondence course whilst I was in prison, and that just meant paper pushing in the same way that I read every document, every line, every sentence of every document that was involved in my case over and over again for years. And I'd become very tuned into how cases worked and didn't work, and I learned so much. Teaching myself how journalists work meant I could manipulate stories that I could send out there. So I'd write letters to some of our national newspapers, The Guardian, The Independent, The Sun, The Mirror, and they'd start to slowly but surely publish my letters or publish little things that I said. And then that triggered what happened next, which was simply that the media, who called me a monster, were all of a sudden starting to question the safety of my conviction. And they were showing interest in coming to visit me. So I'd sit on a visiting table and talk to these journalists about why I was innocent and asking them questions about what they remembered at the time. And that just led to a lot of publicity questioning the safety of my conviction. And that rocked the British criminal justice system to its core. They really started to wobble at the idea that they'd locked up three innocent black men. And once the media started questioning the safety of my conviction, once the media started to remind the new generation of children that three black men were in prison for crimes committed by two white men, we garnered a lot of support. And that made a big difference, because it was then 10 years into my wrongful life imprisonment that barristers and reputable lawyers started to take an interest when I wrote to them asking for their help. And so they did start to help. And then there was one moment where an eminent human rights lawyer discovered that the non-disclosure of the reward money meant that I'd been deprived the right of a fair trial. And that particular lawyer took my case to the European Court of Human Rights. And it was an opportunity to set out the fact that three black men were in prison for crimes committed by two white men, one black man. I had a cast iron alibi, witness had given fabricated evidence, reward money had been paid, and it had not been disclosed. So all this was laid out in front of 29 judges at the European Court of Human Rights, and they unanimously in 1999 ruled that I had been denied the right to a fair trial. And that rocked the British government. And in 2000, the government told the Court of Appeal they had to rehear my case. And it was just a few months after that, my convictions were overturned.
You turned the train around on the tracks. It's amazing that you were able to do it from this dungeon that you were in and even managed to keep your wits about you. Your co-defendants, did they benefit from your work as well? Were they freed when you were?
They were, yes. My co-defendants' convictions were also overturned at the Court of Appeal at the same time that my convictions were overturned. And that happened on the 17th of July, 2000.
And what was that moment like walking out?
From the age of 20 and to the age of 32, I was confined in a single cell by myself. I suffered in those 12 years, and it wasn't until they quashed my convictions, I walked down the steps of the Court of Appeal, they opened up the door that was going to set me free, that I, for the first time, cried. I fell into the arms of my sister, one of my three sisters, and it was the first time I cried in all the years that I was in prison, and it felt so good. And then I walked with my family to the front of the Court of Appeal and shouted my mouth off about how I'd lost so many years of my life in prison to the world's media. The judges cheekily and typically turned round and said, "This is not a declaration of innocence," but they quashed my conviction as unsafe and they set me free. And that was the big turning point. That's when my life began. That wasn't the end of an ordeal. That was the beginning of my life.
That's beautiful. And we should say that even though they quashed your conviction and you were freed, you're still fighting to this day to be exonerated. But you're involved in so many things now, Raphael, and it's awesome to see how you've sort of taken the world by the balls since you came home. So please share with us, what's your life like now?
For me, it was one of those kind of classical right place, right time, right opportunity. From the age of 20 to 32, I studied the law in prison. I studied journalism. So there was only two things I could do when I got out of prison, and that was go down that route of campaigning on behalf of other miscarriage of justice victims. But I just spent 12 years of my own fucking life fighting hard. And as much as I do that in my own way now, the other option was journalism. So that's what I did. I went, I met a man who at the time was a senior figure at the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. He offered me an opportunity. And before I knew it, I was working on the most prestigious radio program here in the United Kingdom called the Radio 4 Today program. And I remember sitting at the desk as a sort of call center, calling up politicians, asking them to come on the program. And after two or three days, I went into the editor and I said, "Listen, you know what? I've just spent 12 years sitting on a cell bed or a cell chair. I can't do this. This is not for me. I need to be free." And he offered me the opportunity to try my hand at being a reporter on this prestigious program. And I accepted. And I didn't look back. I went on to become a reporter on this program. Now, you've got to remember, Jason, and your audience, when I came out of prison, I was handed a mobile phone for the first time. The internet didn't exist when I went to prison. So there were lots of technological developments. So I was learning things on the job at the BBC. And this was within 12 months of getting out. And I worked my way through the BBC, working for the radio program. Then I worked for the prestigious BBC News program. And then I worked for the longest running current affairs investigative program, Panorama, as one of their correspondents. I spent a lot of my early career as a BBC journalist, as an undercover operative, because I knew how to duck and dive, having survived in prison. I had a gift for the gab in that world. And so I spent the next 16 years, having been released from prison, carving out this successful career as a BBC journalist, as a public speaker, as somebody who inspired other people from backgrounds like mine, or bringing together people from my background and the academic or the affluent background to show that we could work together to bring about change in social justice. And I left the BBC after 16, 17 years and then was given the opportunity by Netflix to do this series called Inside the World's Toughest Prisons. And I thought they were crazy to be asking me, having spent so long trying to get the fuck out of prisons, to go back in willingly. I thought long and hard and thought, you know what, I can change people's perceptions about the people that are in these places. I can change people's perceptions about what prison is really like. You know, let's get rid of all this sensational violence stuff. Let's get rid of all this kind of stigma around who these individuals are. And let's try and understand more. And it's been a phenomenal success. I go in prisons all around the world, spend 7 days with the prisoners to try and find the balance between rehabilitation, punishment. In addition to that, I have my own podcast, Second Chance, I talk to people about why they give people a second chance, what their second chance is, what that means to people, not just people that have come out of prison and gone on to become entrepreneurs, or people that have been wrongly convicted who have gone on to lead successful careers like I have, but loads of different questions around what second chance actually means. During the lockdown, first pandemic, I wrote my first book because so many people have asked me about my life story. And although in bits and pieces I've shared it, I've never put it all in one place. So I wrote my autobiography, Notorious, which was published at the end of last year. The most important thing for me, the legacy of everything, is the Raphael Rowe Foundation. And having experienced prisons around the globe, I realized so much needs to be done, not just for the prisoners, but the prisons, to improve the humanity and the ability to rehabilitate or give people a second chance. And that's why I recently set up the Raphael Rowe Foundation, in the hope that my legacy will be to garner people, change their perception about what prisons really are, what they mean, and how they can help people rather than destroy people or their families.
It's great work, and it speaks volumes about your character that you're giving back in the ways that you best can, right? I mean, you have a natural gift for this stuff, and you found your, I'm going to call it your calling. And it's wonderful to see you sort of thriving and, you know, succeeding, I think, beyond any reasonable expectations that anybody could have had, and just making a difference. You know, what can I say, except you have all of my respect, and I'm just glad that you're here today. And of course, for anyone listening who wants to learn more about Raphael's journey and follow it, as I do and as I will, his podcast, his book, the Raphael Rowe Foundation, we're going to have links to all of them in our bio. And I'm sure people can follow you on Instagram, right? And what about other social media?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. I have a website. If you put my name, Raphael Rowe, R-O-W-E, or A Reporter on Twitter or Instagram, you'll be able to find me.
And now we come to the closing of our show. It's called Closing Arguments, and Closing Arguments works just like this. I'm going to kick back in my chair, turn my microphone off, and leave my headphones on. And of course, leave your mic open for you to share any final thoughts you may have with our audience.
I think for me, one of the most important things is, who am I? Who am I? So I shared with you my upbringing. I shared with you my ordeal of being wrongly convicted and imprisoned. I've shared with you a bit about the work that I do now, having got out of prison. You know, when you think you've hit the summit, you never quite hit the summit, because there's always more to climb. And that's what I've done in my successful career as a journalist. But I'm constantly asking myself the question, who am I? And that's what I want people to do. Ask themselves, who are you? Who am I? Am I the person that wants to make lots of money? Am I the person who wants to care for my elderly parent? Am I the person who wants to become a high-performance athlete? I always ask myself the question, who am I? And I've reached what I think is a fair description of myself. I am who I've always been. I'm the same person that I was when I was a kid. I'm the same person that I was when I was in prison, and I'm definitely the same person now that I'm free. And that person is an honest, direct, with morals and values, where I believe not just in myself, but in other people. And by other people, I mean the good, the bad, and the ugly. Why shouldn't I? Why shouldn't you give up a few minutes of your time or your space to see the other side of someone? As I've shown over the years, there are different sides to everybody. The person I am today, as I say, is the same person I was when I was a kid, when I was innocent, when I just enjoyed the things that we all do before we're corrupted by the things that we witness and hear as we get older, or our desires and our wants. So that's my final word. Ask yourself, who are you? Because I know who I am.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Justin Golden, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis, with research by Lila Robinson. The music in this production was supplied by three-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph, Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, as well as at Lava for Good on all three platforms. You can also follow me on both TikTok and Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.